Good evening. My name's John Worrell. It's a privilege to be introducing this, the third Popper Memorial Lecture. First, a word about Karl Popper. As most of you in this audience will know, Popper taught here at LSE from 1946 until his retirement in 1968. In the opinion of many judges, as well as being one of the most significant thinkers to have worked at the LSE, perhaps the most significant thinker to have worked at the LSE, he was one of the most important and influential philosophers of the 20th century. A memorial fund was set up after his death, and we're now intending that that fund support a biennial Popper lecture and an annual Popper prize for the best work by an LSE postgraduate in philosophy on a topic to which Sir Karl himself contributed. The prize will be awarded for the first time this summer, and the third Popper lecture, as you know because you're here, is now. Popper's two-volume work, The Open Society and Its Enemies, had a major impact not only within academic philosophy but also amongst politicians across the surprisingly broad spectrum. Our lecturer today is ideally qualified to assess and reflect Popper's impact in this regard. He's a philosopher of science of international standing, holding a chair in the subject at the University of Pisa and having a number of widely read papers and books to his name. He was moreover heavily influenced by Popper, and indeed became a personal friend of Sir Karl in his later years. So certainly Professor Pera the Popperian then, but also of course Il Presidente Pera, too many P's. He has been for several years very much a professional politician, more P's, and currently holds the position of President of the Italian Senate. So if not exactly one of Plato's philosopher kings, certainly a philosopher president, and perhaps that's the nearest we're going to get in current circumstances. We thank him very much for agreeing to take on this lecture despite his enormously busy schedule. And I should add that he's kindly agreed to answer questions after the lecture for 20 or 30 minutes or so. So let me, without further ado, ask him to deliver the third Popper Memorial Lecture under the title Multiculturalism and the Open Society, a Popperian Approach. Professor Pera.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor to give the Popper Memorial a lecture at this prestigious London School of Economics. I thank you all for being here, and in particular I would like to thank my good friend Professor John Watkins, whom I have known for a long time. I think it's more than 20 years now, John, fortunately. And the many colleagues and friends I see here, Melita Mew and David Miller and Brian McGee and many others. Being here, back fond memories and significant people and events. First of all, of Sir Karl, whom I knew very well, and the many conversations and meetings I had with him, especially once when, after trying to convince him that one of his ideas could be at least disputed, I miraculously survived. And many other things come to my mind. The time I wasted trying to convince Italian philosophers and intellectuals that Popper is not a dead dog. The time I've been spending attempting to convince those politicians who are looking for an idea and not merely for a seat in the parliament, and of course I'm not talking about British politicians, that Popper's thought may be a good point of reference. In short, being here reminds me that my own philosophical life has been somewhat of a failure. And you can understand why that I have started a political life. I hope that Popper is right with his criticism of the principle of induction according to which the future is equal to the past. I had the pleasure to be at the Center for the Natural Resources of Science in 1995 and 96, my last academic year before I became a senator. Whether there is a causal link between these two events, visiting scholar at the London School of Economics and the president of the Italian Senate, is a bold conjecture, which unfortunately for me still still waiting for refutation. Anyway, now let me move on to my lecture. As John said, the title is Multiculturalism and the Open Society for Popperian Approach. As everybody knows, multiculturalism is a label for a variety of things. It applies to facts, problems, theories, and policies. I take multiculturalism for granted, both as a fact and as a problem. As a citizen of a European country, I would be blind if I didn't recognize that in our societies there are many different cultures and groups, traditions, each with its own values, customs, and languages. And I would be stubborn if I didn't acknowledge the problem of how to construct a society, peaceful society, where all these groups and traditions live or coexist peacefully. But I happen to also be a philosopher, at least in the peculiar sense of one who earns, or used to earn, his life by teaching philosophy at university. So therefore I am interested in theories and policies. And here we'll be focusing directly on the theory of multiculturalism and indirectly on the policies stemming from it. More precisely, first we will examine three main philosophical approaches to multiculturalism. That is Derrida's view of hospitality, Charles Taylor's view of communitarianism, and the classical liberalism view of the neutrality of the state. The thesis I shall try to defend is that a Popperian approach to the problems of multiculturalism is sounder and more promising than the other views. It is a pity that nowadays Popper is no longer discussed as he deserves to be. Whether or not this depends on the fact that sometimes professors of philosophy are at odds with the philosophers is a question I leave open. Let me then take my first step by discussing Derrida's views of multiculturalism as it stems from his analysis or from his deconstruction of the concept of hospitality. Deconstruction is a polite postmodern, as they say, expression. As I understand it, is the philosophically correct equivalent of internal critique. To deconstruct a concept or an idea is to show its incompleteness or internal inconsistencies. This, in my view, implies that deconstructivists are like half philosophers. They criticize, but they don't know and cannot go beyond the positions that are internally criticized. Speaking of the constructive politics or of the constructive policy of immigration, for example, is tantamount to speaking of an oxymoron. And Derrida's analysis of hospitality is a typical case. When we grant hospitality to strangers, Derrida maintains, we agree to protect them, even though they are foreign to us. It seems that the best way to accomplish this task is to open our public space to foreigners by sharing with them our rights and our responsibilities. To make this process easier, we should teach them our language as well. In a word, we integrate them in our culture, but then this very concept of integration reveals its cultural and psychological violence. Giving hospitality no longer means giving protection to someone who is foreign to us, since it now implies that he or she must become like us. And such hospitality is paradoxical in character. We give hospitality to a foreigner to the extent in which we succeed in making him or her no longer be a foreigner. Should we then accept the other unconditionally, And this too is paradoxical, at least according to Derrida's analysis. The law of unconditional hospitality is in conflict with the very same laws of hospitality, since accepting the other's culture without asking him or her to accept our set of responsibilities and rights might destroy the foundation on which our own culture is based. Unconditional hospitality, therefore, is as inconsistent as conditional hospitality. And what are, if any, the political consequences of this, the construction of the concept of hospitality? Multiculturalists like Derrida believe that we should abandon our current policies of integration and adopt instead a program whose task is the realization of rainbow societies, where different and incompatible traditions may coexist on mutually good terms. Unfortunately, there is no guarantee that such societies are stable and peaceful, or at least there is no positive argument to this effect. Therefore, the consequence of the construction of the idea of hospitality is a confused political theory with no suggestion of operative specific policies. I'm fairly sure that Derrida would agree. However, he tries to transform what I consider a serious flaw of deconstructionism into one of its merits. Proposing a political theory, Derrida claims, means to accept what we understand as politics in our culture, while his aim is precisely to question the whole tradition in which the demand for theories is embedded. And yet, even if we are to accept his views, Derrida himself would have to accept the following question as reasonable. Once we have deconstructed the idea of hospitality, or the idea of a political theory, or the idea of a Western tradition, how should we behave with foreigners? Derrida's answer is an outstanding example of irritating vagueness. He argues that hospitality can neither be turned into mere integration, nor can it be unconditional. In an interview, he claims that it must be negotiated and invented every step of the way and placed somewhere in between unconditional and conditional hospitality. But precisely where, Derrida doesn't say. In the same interview, he admits that this policy is very risky. And I believe he's right. And I take concessions like this as an implicit admission of the conceptual sterility of his view. Deconstructivism, it seems to me, is a very poor philosophy, with no positive or negative consequences. The only policy it can recommend amounts to no more than the famous anything goes, probably the best advice for fashionable academics, certainly the worst for responsible politicians. Furthermore, Derrida doesn't save himself from the danger of self-referential arguments. As a deconstructivist, he is committed to the idea that the alleged objective assessment of political theories conceal a struggle for power of some group or other. But who are these groups? Are the constructivists themselves one such group? If they are not, should we take the constructivists as the only enlightened souls who do not struggle for power? If they are, should we conclude that Derrida himself is cunningly aiming at power? I don't know the answers to this question, nor I'm not interested in the question. So let me now take my second step and ascertain whether communitarianism, especially as presented in Charles Taylor's influential work, provides us with a better theory of multiculturalism. There are two main tenets of communitarianism. The first is that individuals are embedded in communities which shape their identity. That is to say, there can be no individual identity without cultural identity. And the second tenet of communitarianism is that not only individuals, but communities as well have rights. That is to say, there can be no individual rights without community rights. The communitarian view generates both theoretical and political consequences. One is fundamental. We may call it the survival principle. It maintains that the survival of a culture is a good in itself, and societies must be active in defending the rights of a minority community. If a minority community is in danger of extinction, some individual rights may be restricted or even forfeited in order to enable the community to survive. Unlike the deconstructivists, Taylor is careful in rejecting the charge of relativism. He claims that cultures can be compared and evaluated. And this implies that at the end of our investigation, not all cultures will be considered of equal importance or value. Let's call this view the objective assessment thesis. That is, cultures can be evaluated. It seems to me that the objective assessment thesis is at odds with the survival principle. Cultures and communities are not static entities. They continuously undergo change. It is assumed that all or most people in community A want to leave it and reach community B. Suppose that these people wanted to move after an objective assessment, according to which the culture of community B is better than that of A, for some reason or other, for example, given new social or technological or environmental developments. The question is, should we force people to worsen their lives in the name of the survival principle, or should we let them choose freely in the name of the objective assessment thesis? If we opt for the latter, then we must admit that the survival principle is not a good in itself, but a good instrumental to the well-being of individuals, who therefore have rights above and beyond the rights of the communities to which they belong. My view is that the survival principle is independent of the communitarian analysis of the self. Though we allow that personal identity depends on a sense of belonging to a culture, this does not imply that the culture in question must necessarily be the one in which individuals were born. The right for a culture does not mean the right for the single, specific, original culture. The defense of minority communities that Taylor and the other many multiculturalists like Professor Kimlicka strongly advocate seems reasonable to me in certain cases and not in others. For example, when such a community is no longer proved to be vital and thus able to evolve autonomously. I do agree that even dying communities deserve respect, but I'm not sure that we show them respect if we confine them to a sort of a protected social zoo like endangered species. So let me move on to the liberal view of multiculturalism. And the question, my question is whether this classical view does better than the deconstructivism or communitarianism. Classical liberal thought is committed to what might be called the principle of a multiple divisions. Division between the individual and the state, between the state and the religion, between civil society and the state, between the private sphere and the public sphere. According to liberalism, individuals, and individuals alone, have natural rights, which can be justified by some a priori theory like Kant's, or some anthropological theory like Mill's, or other rational theory like John Rawls. The principle of multiple divisions, which became widespread in Europe after the religious wars, has as a fundamental consequence the principle of the neutrality of the state. According to this principle, individuals are free to pursue their own ideas of a good life, including religious choice, within their private spheres, whereas the state is not the bearer of any substantive values and limits itself to adopting those procedures that grant natural rights. In this view, there is no room for any rational value conflicts, whether they be conflicts among individuals, since they are free to follow their own ideas of good, or conflicts between the state and the individual, because the state is neutral to the individual's own choices. Multiculturalism, therefore, is a fact which poses no special problem. The two above mentioned principles do not exhaust the classical liberal theory, which also contains a third, an important principle, namely the principle of the composibility of all values, that supports them both. It is because all values are composable, that is, not in conflict in the public sphere, that the state must be neutral. And it is because the state is neutral that there can be no real value conflicts. The idea is very attractive, and indeed it has attracted the best European minds for centuries. Unfortunately, I do not believe it works. On this point, I do agree with Professor John Gray of the London School of Economics when he writes that liberties are not elements in a structure of composable rights. And instead of discussing this idea in general terms, I shall give a concrete example. L'affaire du foulard, that is the controversial decision of the Bernastasi Commission to forbid the French Muslim girls from wearing the hijab at school. At the first glance, this decision seems to be wrong because the members of the commission have not applied the principle of composability. After all, teenagers are used to wearing accepting clothes. And if we accept eccentric fashion, think of piercing, for example, why should we not tolerate the Muslim teenagers wearing the hijab at school? However, this way of interpreting and applying the principle of composability misconstrues the deeper reasons underlying the controversy. Had the hijab been a matter of fashion, the controversy would never have been born. The Stasi Commission validated a very strong idea of the neutrality of the state. This idea is related to the value of laïcité, a term which is difficult to translate into English, which emphasizes that education is not a private affair because it concerns all citizens as a community. Education is a public affair. And this is where the public and the private comes into conflict, and the principle of compossibility is out of place. Consider the situation. On the one hand, the state relegates religion and its symbols to the private sphere. On the other, individuals, Muslim girls, take the hijab as a symbol of belonging to their culture and want it to be protected in the public sphere. And there is clearly a genuine conflict between two values here. One value accepted by a state, and the other professed by certain individuals or groups. But if a state accepts and imposes as well a value in contrast with the other values professed by individuals or groups, then the principle of multiple divisions is false. The principle of the compossibility of values is false too. And the principle of the neutrality of the state doesn't function. Because the public sphere, in this case, turns out not to be an empty space. I do agree that these principles are all helpful and valuable. At least they have set the ground on which Western societies have flourished. But under philosophical scrutiny, they prove to be too idealistic and too optimistic. And looking for something more realistic, I take my last step and turn my eyes to Popper's approach to multiculturalism. If I'm not mistaken, neither multiculturalism nor value pluralism ever appear as expressions in Popper's writings. But he could not help but acknowledge them as facts. After all, his great Vienna was a highly cosmopolitan city where different communities lived together in a culturally fruitful way. As he wrote in one of his late essays, the population of Europe is the result of mass migrations, which gave rise to a linguistic, ethnic, and cultural mosaic, a chaotic jumble which cannot possibly be disentangled. But not only did Popper recognize the fact of value pluralism, he also appreciated and advocated it. As he also wrote, had there been no Tower of Babel, we should invent it. For value pluralists such as Popper, value conflict is a basic and undeniable feature of our moral world. And given this fact, the question they ask is, how can we construct a society which respects individual freedom as much as possible, without at the same time leading to its own destruction? Popper's answer to this is, through the method of a dialogue, a specification of which is the method of falsification, of conjectures or refutation, or trial and error, and so on, as practiced in scientific research. This method as an organon, that is a logic, or an instrument, that is, to use my own terminology, not Popper's, dialectics or logic. Dialectics rests on a normative principle, which we may call the principle of a commitment to dialogue. It states that one has a moral obligation to engage oneself in an exchange with others. Dialectics also rests on a factual claim. It says that if one is honestly committed to engage in a dialogue, then no matter how far another's view might be from one's own, one can find a point of departure, a hook, something to hang on to, from which a fruitful, though sometimes difficult and painful, discussion can stem. What is important with this view, and what is important with dialogue, is more its sense than its method. dialogue does not primarily aim at unanimity or consensus or conversion or conviction. It aims at mutual understanding. After a dialogue, interlocutors may or may not change their mind, but in any case, they become enriched, more open, more inclined to appreciate views different from their own. Dialogue is critical, not dogmatic. And the open society is not a light and easy rainbow society where anything goes, like that envisioned and advocated by many multiculturalists. The open society is a hard and difficult society indeed, where commitment to dialogue is fundamental, and only those who really want to engage in a dialogue may become citizens. Popper's principle of commitment to dialogue, in my view, does better than Derrida's the constructivism. For example, it meets the concern of minority groups and their desire for recognition. It raises immigrants to the status of full citizens. It allows for positive actions such as offering school curricula based on specific features of different cultural traditions. It may even provide funds for minority religious institutions. There are constraints, of course. Those fanatic, fundamentalist, and aggressive individuals or groups who oppose a pluralism of values or traditions are to be controlled. But this should not be seen as a violent move adopted by the majority or host group to its advantage. This is vindicated by the anti-dogmatism of the open society to the advantage of one and all. Well, one might think that policies inspired by value pluralism, such as Popper's, boil down to teaching the value of tolerance. And this is wrong. If we are committed to dialogue, if we wanted to learn from others, then we have to consider their views as being endowed with positive values. And this requires more, much more than tolerance. It requires respect. Tolerance is a passive attitude. We are capable of tolerating even ideas and actions that we find unacceptable. Respect is an active virtue. It asks for mutual understanding, and when appropriate, for corrections of our respective habits. And this has wide political implications. Host countries should ask foreigners or immigrants to be not only tolerant, but also respectful. Immigration problems cannot be solved in terms of tolerance and the protection of public order alone. This was the illusion of a classical liberalism. To be citizens of the open society, immigrants should learn the values and traditions of the host country. Therefore, they should learn the language and the history of the country where they live. Without a common language, we fall back to the wild rainbow society of the deconstructivists. A Popperian approach to multiculturalism seems to me to be preferable not only deconstructivism and the classical liberalism, but the communitarianism as well. The principle of a commitment to dialogue encourages traditions to demonstrate their merits. As Popper claimed, each idea should prove its worth, and no idea should be silenced too soon. However, the same principle, the principle of commitment to dialogue, implies that during the dialogue, certain traditions may prove to be weaker than others, or become less vital, or look less attractive, or meet difficult problems, or end up with insurmountable difficulties. The principle of a commitment to dialogue, therefore, admits and implies the cultural selection of groups and traditions. No group or tradition has a right then for survival independent of its merits and the freedom of individuals to exhibit them. In conclusion, if Popper is right, we have a promising philosophical framework within which we can organize our policies in a multicultural society. These policies may not always be clear-cut or precise enough to instruct leaders or governments. Popper was neither a politician nor a chef. He was a philosopher. He provided us with ideas to develop, not political programs to adopt or recipes to prepare. Real politicians cannot dispense with some theoretical ideas, as well as good chefs cannot disregard the art in cooking. Popper provided a good idea, a very good one in my view. And as far as the recipe is concerned, well, it's about time for dinner. And in spite of my Italian taste, let's be optimistic and hope that Popper left a good heritage at the London School's kitchen too. Thank you.
Things with free dinner either, free lunch, so you've still got to answer some questions before we move on to that stage. There are two microphones upstairs and two downstairs. If anybody would like to ask a question, could they indicate by raising their arm? Could they then, I'll then direct the chap at the front here. Could you say your name?
Sure. I am Alberto Nones, and I am Italian postgraduate here at the LSE. And I wanted to ask if it's possible to ask a question to the President of the Senate. No?
What do you mean by a question to the President of the Senate?
No, because...
Depends on the questions.
Yes. Well, it's a very brief question anyway, and... because Mr. Berlusconi, on 2001, you know, we remember that promised a law on the conflict of interests, and this law is got stuck in the Senate, of which President Pera is the president. And so I would like to know if something is going to happen in this direction. And the second brief question is about the crucifix, the question of crocifisso in public spaces, and because there is a bill of the Lega Nord, that's one of the parties of which Forza Italia, Pera's party, is ally, that would like to display the crucifix in all public spaces. Thank you.
Well, thank you. The first question is exactly the question you cannot ask to the President of the Senate. And as far as the philosophical aspect, because there is a philosophical aspect of this, the second question, that is the question of the crucifix, which is similar to the hijab in France. The decision in an individual, a Muslim, went to tribunal in order to ask to put the crucifix, which is in our classrooms, out. And the question is, as in the case of the Bernard Stasi decision, is whether or not you take religion as whether or not you take religion as public value which has to be guaranteed by the state. So if you advocate, and if you maintain a view according to which the state has to be completely neutral, then religion will become just a private question, and of course you have to be tolerant. But if, as in the case of Italy or in the case of France, religion, in our case, Catholic religion, is part of education, and this continues to be an important part of the education, then the state has to protect it and to protect the religious symbols against people or foreigners or immigrants or whoever who wanted to eliminate them. So it depends on what kind of a state you want to have. A very liberal state, a minimal state, doesn't allow you to protect religion. A state which wants to protect the tradition of its citizens, that's in the case of France and Italy, does exactly the opposite. So in Italy's case, doesn't allow to have the crucifix out of classrooms, and in the French case, does exactly the opposite. So compels the people to not to wear a hijab at school. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Nidhi Trehan. I'm a PhD student in sociology. Very interesting lecture, Professor Pera. I am doing my research on Hungary, where through the influence of George Soros and the Open Society Institute in Hungary, many of Popper's ideas were actually, in a sense, quite influential in Hungarian politics, and especially with respect to the Romani, the Gypsy minority of Hungary, which is the largest minority in Hungary, and which will be one day soon the largest minority in Europe. And as you know, the Roma have been living in Europe for 1,000 years and are not a foreigner immigrant as such, although they may be in the same position of political marginalization. My question to you concerns what I find is one of the severe limitations, I would say, of this politics of dialogue. Because eventually, I think if theories have any meaning, they must be transformed into a kind of politics. And I think you're suggesting through your lecture, through your ideas, that Popperian concepts can be translated into politics. And I would submit to you that unfortunately, at least in the case of Hungary with Romani politics, what has happened is that the politics of dialogue have actually transformed into political marginalization for the Roma. We now have token institutions in Hungary. We have the Gypsy minority self-government, which is more or less dominated by a few handful of people. So basically, I think that's one of the severe limitations of the Popperian approach. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Well, as I tried to say, the Popperian view, the view of the Popperian society is, it's not an easy view. It's a hard view. It's a difficult view. Because if you ask people to respect each other, which is quite different from asking them to tolerate them. Because as I tried to say, toleration, it's an easy solution. You allow people to do what they want, you tolerate them, you don't like them, you don't like their habits and so on and so forth, but you tolerate them. And because the other aspect of the coin is that you don't care of them. So just that is why you easily tolerate them. But if you are committed to dialogue, that means that you are ready to learn something from them. You are ready to consider them as endowed with some values, some positive values. And so you are committed to a dialogue. You cannot leave a community within some limits and leave it there like in a social zoo, as I try to say. You have to ask them or allow them to have some rights, ask them to respect their duties, and then you have to confront in a dialogue with them. You may learn something from that community. That community can learn something from your community. And so you must be open to have a mix of other values, because that's the way you grow up, even as an individual. So it's not easy to translate this political view into real policies. The only thing we cannot do is just to have a minority community, leave it there, not caring of it, and just tolerating it. So you must have both rights and duties. And the state, in this case, can also be prepared to help this minority community. For example, as I tried to say, funding them, fund some of their institutions, introduce in school curricula some of the features of their culture, and so on and so forth. So it's not exactly the kind of society, the open society I was speaking about, is not exactly the kind of society we see in our Western countries. Western countries are rather close to open society, but they still have to work in order to have this commitment, or real commitment to dialogue, or commitment to a real dialogue among communities.
Hello, my name is Rasmus. I'm an MSc student here at the institution. How should a just multicultural society deal with cultural groups, ethnic communities, for whom an essential part of their identity is exactly to reject the commitment to dialogue? You said we should control the fundamentalists, but what does that mean, and how should we philosophically justify that?
Well, controlling fanatics or fundamentalists is a consequence of an open society, because in an open society, you are an individual with your own values and rights, and I am the same. And I recognize you as an individual with your rights. And I am also prepared to learn something from you. So there is a limit. And the limit is that if you are a full individual with rights, and I am a full individual with my own rights, the limit is that you cannot be aggressive, you cannot be violent. You must be committed to dialogue and to talk to me, and I have to do the same. So if you are a fanatic or a fundamentalist or whoever, a violent guy, so you must be controlled, because you cannot become a citizen of an open society if you use this instrument, let's say violence and aggression and so on and so forth.
There's a question there, gentlemen, with a gray suit.
Professor Perra, as I understand it,
where is it? Oh, sorry.
Professor Perra, as I understand it, your appeal to dialogue, which is very persuasive, rests on the idea of reason, reasonable dialogue. But so often in multicultural society, there's not an appeal to reason, but an appeal to authority. You haven't dealt with this word. How do you incorporate it into your system?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure there are real communities in the world. I mean, especially if we think about immigrants coming to Western countries, which do not make any appeal to reason. Some groups or people may understand the reason maybe in a different way for ours, but I do believe that even if you are a foreigner, if you come from a culture quite different from mine, but if I want to talk to you, then I can find something, I can start a discussion. It may be difficult, it may be painful at the beginning. We may have quite different views about reason, about religion, or whatever, but we can start discussing. And once we start, of course I try to to confute you, falsify your views, you can do the same, and as long as the discussion goes on, then we find bigger and bigger grounds on which we can base our discussion. And that's the way in which we can learn from each other. So at the beginning, we may start for just a single point, but this is painful. You cannot do that. We agree on something. Once we agree on something, we continue to discuss, and we find a bigger place on which we can continue our discussion. Unless we imagine a community which has no idea of reason, but in which case it would be almost impossible to even to start a discussion. But other from that, I don't know real possible communities which don't have an idea of a reason. I think, apart from this extreme radical case, I think that discussion in a way are like translations. I can translate in one language into another. I'm sure that when I translate, I lose something. There is something
is missing. When a complete meaning of an expression in one language cannot be rendered in another language. But at least there is a confrontation, there is discussion, there is a way of understanding. And that's the way we should behave with immigrants and minority or immigrant groups or with foreigners in any case.
My name is Valentino Larcinese. I'm a lecturer in this university. Professor Pera, in spite of the nice lecture you gave us tonight, it's still hard to forget that you are an eminent member of Silvio Berlusconi's party, Forza Italia. Now, the prime minister you support owns 50% of national television in Italy and controls through the political process another 50%. Now my question is, why do you lend your support to such a situation if, as I genuinely believe, you are a liberal? Is this your ideal of what an open society should be?
Unfortunately, I can't give you an answer here, but to be polite with you, if you offer me a cup of tea afterwards, like we can have a private discussion.
Gentleman at the back with the red shirt.
I'm a visiting fellow from Macedonia at the Center for Study of Global Governance. Somehow the multiculturalism turned in Macedonia to be biculturalism lately, and it linked to the power and the resources. Who has the power and resources has the public sphere or whatever. This very interesting lesson reminds me of market society, because you mentioned competition else. My question would be, what, according to your opinion, would be the crucial actors in this open society of Popperian approach? Who will dictate the game besides the power and resources? Is there another space to play or to have dialogue? Thank you.
No, I don't think there is another space. I mean, there is a private, in this view, there is a private sphere, which is a private space, and the public space, the state. What I wanted to stress is the public space is not a completely empty space. Because if it is an empty space, then you have a situation like the Stasi Commission decision and so on and so forth. So you cannot avoid the conflicts and tensions and conflicts. So in a Popperian view, the public space, which is the values that a state incorporates in itself, is not empty, as there are some values. But what kind of values? Especially one. The state dictates this specific single value. You, citizens, have to respect each other. I'm not imposing you a single view. I don't want you adopt this rather than that religion. I want you to respect each other, because I know that if you respect each other, then you can learn one from the other, and the society or the civil society can grow. So the policies that from this view can be adopted is just policies who help people having a dialogue, for example, schools, for example, associations, a private association, and so on and so forth. This is the view, this view of the open society is different from the classical liberal view, because in the classical liberal view, I mean, think about the minimum state. In the classical liberal view, the state has no values at all. And this is not the case with the open society. That's why it's difficult and a hard society to live in.
Back in the blue sweater.
My name is Claudio Valcagno. I'm a student at this school. I've always been favoring a bipolar political system, especially after seeing the Italian political life between 1950 and 1990. But how does that, via the median voter theorem, deal with minorities in the sense that it will be the policy right in the median who will win in the end, right? That's only, of course, if you've got one dimension. so it's simplifying. But how does that cater for those at the end? So for minorities, really.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood the question. Can you rephrase it in different terms?
I guess you're familiar with the median voter theorem.
Yeah.
How do you escape it in this context of multiculturalism? How do people who are representing a minority get represented in parliament or via some political process if it is those in the median who will always win?
Well, I'll think about it. I don't have an answer, to tell you the truth. Now I understand. I really don't have an answer. I have an idea, but I don't have a real clear idea about it. So I don't want to say something very, very silly.
Tal, just there with the laser on.
Yes, my name is Talal Debs. I'm a visiting fellow in the Department of Philosophy. And you seem to be placing a lot of faith in this constructive dialogue that happens between usually people with very differing views. And as a philosopher of science, I'm surely you're familiar with the general idea of Wittgensteinian forms of life, or if you want to talk in terms of paradigms, we can talk that way. But don't we often find that people in different groups have such a different interpretive grid that really to assume there's going to be constructive dialogue might be quite an assumption indeed. I just wonder what you think about essentially the problem of incommensurability, to put it in philosopher of science speak.
Well, this is a very good question for my friend John Worrell, because he's working hard in order to confute that view. I mean, I'm familiar with the views of incommensurability, forms of life, forms of language, and so on and so forth. But I do believe there is an exaggeration here. I do not really know of any groups or communities having forms of life which are completely ununderstandable or untranslatable into other forms of life. That may be difficult. That may be hard. That's why I said that at the basis of the open society, there is a moral duty. There's not a fact. There is no guarantee at all. But I have the moral duty to talk to you. I come from I have my own form of life, my own language, my own tradition. It might be conceptually incommensurable or logically incommensurable with yours. But in any case, if I have the moral duty, then I start a discussion. And after a while, something happens. A dialogue becomes helpful and fruitful, and the civil society, decent civil society, can be constructed.
Maybe two more questions?
Yes.
The man with the suit there?
Yes, I'm also Italian, but I do not have a question for Marcello Pera as a politician, but as a philosopher.
How can it be?
I don't know. Just for a change.
It's a foreign community.
No, I'm a PhD student here in economics, so I'm not a philosopher. However, my question is the following. It appears to me that the approach that you are comparing are not that much comparable among them, because you are comparing approach which prescribes outcomes, expected results, even values, which is very true also for liberalism, with an approach which tells us about a method to arrive to a solution. I'm not completely sure that you can say that Popperian approach is a superior or inferior to the others, which also has got a consequence. Because if you say that dialogue is the method, what then we say about very specific things, like for instance, if you talk about multiculturalism, about very, very specific things, like for instance, what is the optimal level of foreigners that a country may desire? I mean, in these terms, liberalism has got a very, you know, very specific recommendation to give, which is the answer of an approach which is just method? That's my question.
Yeah, let me say first a few things about the way I try to compare these views. Because there are, of course, if you are a politician and you go to the parliament or you're a member of the government and you take policies, even if you don't think about that, but there is always a view underlying your decisions. And especially in the case of how you deal with question of immigration, that means that you have a view, at least a view about what kind of society or multi-ethnic or multicultural society you want to have. Now, so I was trying to focus on different views. Let's think about the liberal view, for which I have a lot of sympathy, of course. I found it was very important, valuable. After all, when our Western society depend a lot on the application liberal views, but I found it too optimistic. Because a liberal view is the view according to which the state is neutral. The state doesn't have any positive value, doesn't pose any value, because it allows citizens to be completely free. And that's why I say that there is a principle of a composability of values underlying that view. But as the Stasi decision, the commission, the Stasi commission decision shows, if you approach that episode in liberal terms, what your decision or policy would amount to be? Well, you can say people are free to follow their values and choice, including religious choice. It's not my job, the state must say. It's not my job, it's their job. But you think about what kind of citizens you want, you as a state you want. And you start saying, okay, I want that kind of education, not the other kind of education, because this kind of, at least public education, is better for me than the others. That means that the liberal state is failing, in the sense that you are introducing into a liberal state, which is supposed to be neutral, that is, with no values at all, think of a Nazi state, you introduce some values. At that point, you have the conflict. A value professed by the state in the name of citizens and a value professed by groups. So that approach is promising, is important, but it's not the best approach, in my view. The liberal, the open society view does a bit better, because in that case, the state imposes something, but it imposes not a positive value, education. It imposes the principle of dialogue, which is much more important, much more difficult, painful, whatever it is, but it's a different value imposed by the state, not exactly a value like a religious state. And as far as the other approaches are concerned, I try to show that the postmodernist relativist view as the consequence of having a lot of conflicts and the tensions within society and with no solution at all. Communitarian view is an important view. And I do agree with that view in the sense that I do agree that there are collective rights. Communities have rights as such. But there is no survival principle. They don't have rights independent of how they evolve. Some communities may die. So many other communities may become weaker. And so you don't want to let them live even when they are no longer vital or helpful and so on and so forth.
I'm Riccardo Puglisi, and I'm a PhD student in economics here at LSE. I've seen that it's quite difficult to make you talk about politics, so I will try to make you talk about policies. My point is, what do you think about the idea of giving voting rights to legal immigrants, at least in local elections?
Well, as I said, if you accept the open society view and you consider individuals as endowed with values and rights,
then of course you allow them to become full citizens. And as long as far as they are full citizens, they have the right to vote. It's a question of real policy, of a negotiation, is a question of opportunity to establish at when, exactly when, after 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and so on and so forth, allow immigrants to vote. Or, for example, is a practical question to allow citizens to vote either for political elections or administrative elections or local elections, and so on and so forth. This is a question of political negotiation. The real point of principle is that you have to allow them to become full citizens, which also implies at a certain point to vote for general assemblies, a parliament, a local council, and so on and so forth.
Okay, we need to move on soon to refute Marcello's conjecture about the LSC chef, but a couple, maybe two more questions.
Okay.
Chap here with the blue shirt.
Hi, I'm John Wellborn. I'm an economics PhD student here at the LSE. I agree with your criticism of liberalism that the idea of the value-neutral state is optimistic. But I guess it seems to me that the idea that we can have, that your view is equally optimistic. And as an economist, I think about incentives and costs and benefits and institutions and the stability of those institutions. And my question to you is, why should I, as an agent in a society, want to engage in a dialogue? And why should I want to respect? What incentive do I have to go beyond just tolerating, to respect? How will that lead to create the right incentives for me to be a successful agent in that society? I may not be making myself clear.
Well, you may be right, of course. I may be too optimistic about the question, why should I respect, and on what basis I can, on what ground I can base my respect, has no answer. It's an axiom. I have to respect the people. You can give some pragmatic consequences, thinking of possible consequences if you don't grant respect, or if you don't respect the others. You may have a very wild, aggressive, and violent society, which you don't want, of course. And so I start with an axiom. I start with a foundation. Dialogue is a moral principle. It's not, of course, it's not a fact. As a matter of fact, it's unfortunately not a fact. I can't demonstrate it. I accept it as my own duty. And I try to develop the consequence. So what might happen if I accept the commitment to dialogue as a principle? What are the consequences? And I tried to suggest that at least some of these consequences are rather important, in the sense that they can allow us to construct societies more peaceful than they are today.
Next lawyer.
Professor Pera, I would like to respectfully suggest that while the call to dialogue is attractive, I don't think anything follows from it. I don't think from that you can deduce that immigrants should eventually be given voting rights. You could equally well deduce that you could persuade them that they should return to their own country, or a whole range of things. I don't think anything follows in the way of decision making from simply saying that it's a good idea if people engage in dialogue. I'd like to see how you could deduce any policy decision with respect to any issue, tariffs, death penalty, anything at all that you would like, from call to dialogue.
Well, I'm not sure that the principle of dialogue is so vague that I cannot deduce anything precise enough. I mean, if I want to engage a dialogue with this guy, apart from the fact that he's a good friend of mine, but he comes from another country. I don't know his language. I don't understand him. He behaves in a quite different way. He looks very strange to me, but I want to understand him. Suppose, After all, he's from the University of London School of Economics. I come from the University of Pisa, so two worlds apart. But anyway, suppose I want. Suppose I accept the axiom, the moral axiom. I have to. I have moral duty to engage in dialogue with him. Then I start. At first I say, well, it's really very strange. I mean, he has a very strange language. I don't understand what he's saying. Maybe he's irrational. Or maybe he's crazy. But I have to. So after a while, I understand his language, I understand his culture, I understand something, I understand we share something apart from our biological equipment. And then the deduction is, well, I have the right of expressing my own ideas. I should grant him the same right. I have the right to go around freely, and I should to grant him the same right. I have the right to vote, and I should grant him to the same right. So this is a deduction. Maybe this, the term deduction is, I take deduction is in a rather Pickwickian sense. I do agree. I mean, I know that philosophers, especially analytic philosophers, are people who have a very very difficult problems with analysis, and they have a very nice taste about the use of words. But anyway, maybe deduction is not the precise word in this case, but of course there are implications. There are implications. And I try to show that if I accept that moral axiom, then the implications are rather positive, difficult. Very difficult, because of course I have to. Even when he looks completely different from me, even if he looks crazy, and I have to continue to make an effort, and to make an effort on my own nature, and that's why that open society is not easy. Is not a light society. It's not a rainbow in the sense that, I mean, he has different color. He's black. I'm white. He's red. I'm blue. And so on. So I don't care about this color. No, I do care. I do want. I do have to care. And if I start with this view, then at least some consequences follow. Follow is another intriguing expression and word in this case. Thank you.
Alex, could you get the microphone so everyone can hear?
Sorry, the question was, would you have found Socrates guilty or not guilty, whatever the penalty?
Guilty for what?
What he was charged with. Corrupting the youth by having dialogue with them.
Well, next question will be about Jesus Christ and Barabbas. Well, okay, so we can stop here. Well, it's the principle that's why Popper used to mention Socrates many times, because he considered him as the inventor of the method of dialogue. But well, just think about that case. The moral duty of a dialogue and respecting the other was important in Socrates' case. He didn't accept to escape from the jail in the name of that principle. He accepted the principle, he accepted the consequences, and after the trial, he accepted to go to be sentenced and to go to death. So that is the very first view, according to Popper, the principle of dialogue. And I think that I'm not sure whether it was right or wrong in terms of the trial, but I think that he was right if I accept that principle of commitment to dialogue. In this case, you can also understand that why that principle is a very hard and difficult principle to apply to our own lives too.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I think it's time for Marcello and I to go and have our private discussions
okay.
To start to understand each other, since I don't want to abuse the chair by asking questions myself. I think we should thank him very much for a very fine tribute to Sir Karl Popper. Thank you very much.
Thank you.